Welcome, Corinne.
Thank you.
Corinne's a fellow ecumenical Zen Vajrayana practitioner. You missed this morning's discussion about whether or not deities and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are real or not. It's a big topic. Because Dogen's talking about making stupas and Buddha images. Actually, I also looked up the word idol. And something like worshipping a physical object as the object of worship. So then it's a little bit ambiguous, because are these, you know, there's a physical object that we're making the offerings to, but is it just the physical object that's inherently holy in and of itself? I mean, not exactly. I think it's in this realm of Buddha Dharma, it's all like, it's all about the mind, so it's what we imbue it with. And everything is like that, right? Which Dogen's going to get into if we say, well, let's do away with the physical stuff and just go inward. It's like, well, that's anything we think of, any practice, inward kind of practice, is just more of the same. If physical things are constructed, then mental things are constructed. If mental things are not constructed, then physical things are not constructed. Something like this. And that the nature of mind, the empty nature of mind, is Dharmakaya, the empty aspect of our mind's nature. Is the Dharma body, the luminous manifest aspect, is the Sambhogakaya, which is the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, is the luminous manifest aspect of mind. Because these are always a unity, this is the real Buddha or Bodhisattva. This is Toku Urgin Rinpoche. So how can one say that they don't exist? They are the manifest aspect of enlightened essence. They don't come from the outside, these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They don't come from the outside, or outside of us. Rather, that which is already naturally present within ourselves is simply revealed. So it's, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are part of our own mind nature, always here, part of Buddha nature. And then they're naturally revealed, you know, at certain times, you could say. They're manifest or revealed, maybe when we're relating to them in a very wholehearted way. And maybe they come to us in dreams or visions. That which is already present within ourselves, as the great compassionate Bodhisattva, for example, is simply revealed. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have been here all the time. So you could say, really the perfect wisdom Bodhisattva Manjushri, or the perfect great compassion Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, are part of our own nature? My understanding is that yeah, they actually are. Like perfectly pure, distorted, impartial compassion is actually our own Buddha nature. And Avalokiteshvara is part of our own nature of mind, and that it's manifested or revealed through practice. This is one way of looking at this. So then, in order to create conditions for revealing what's already here, we can do things like make offerings to wooden images. So, with all this in mind, I still don't know whether this is idol worship or not. If we understand it that way, that we're just the wooden image is, it's just a skillful means to reveal the nature of our mind. And even empowering the wooden image as an actual Buddha is still this mind activity. Right? Yes.
So it all comes down to who is approaching that Buddha figure and what they're, how they connect with both themselves and that figure.
Yeah.
So it's not, the figure has nothing to do with it, it's each person's approach to that.
Yeah, and yeah, there's nothing special about the figure.
No.
And but it's how we relate to it, yeah. So it's going to be different for everyone. And that thing that there's nothing special about the figure reminds me, is in accord with the teaching of, like, with Shakyamuni Buddha. He was like the supreme Nirmanakaya Buddha of our Kalpa, right? And so many people, they just see him and have some kind of like awakening. But some people, because of like karmic obstructions, they'd meet the Buddha and like actually get angry at him. And like his cousin Devadatta, right? It's like, so it's not something that there was actually in the physical being of the Buddha. It's more like how everybody sees the Buddha according to their own karma. So it's somewhat similar, I think, to how each of us relate to a physical image. Yes.
And then I was kind of, as I was contemplating the Sambhogakaya aspect, as I was meditating, in many, if not all traditions, there's the wise being has a halo, or is often depicted as being gold.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
was like, because like when we were over in India, it was like, man, they really get carried away with gold. I was like, blamed out these Buddhas. But I realized, it's like, oh, okay, I think that's just trying to communicate the luminous aspect of the being.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of when beings get to a certain point of embodying kind of in their wisdom, they are that Sambhogakaya kind of energy.
Yeah.
That people are just naturally attracted to it.
Yeah.
I mean, they see it even.
Yeah.
Their aura or their halo.
Yeah.
I guess the closest thing we've got to it now is the Dalai Lama. There's just a quality of kind of luminosity.
Mm-hmm. And you feel it. It's a vibration.
I feel, right.
We might say, yeah.
So it isn't just what, I don't think it's just what, it's an interesting question. Well, is it that we're imbuing?
Yeah, it's not.
The kind of then us versus them. Maybe not everybody feels that about the Dalai Lama. They just look at him, the Chinese, he's just a guy. Whereas other people tune into that, and maybe it's because it resonates with some of their own quality of the Sambhogakaya.
Yeah. There's causes and conditions. Things aren't just random, and you can't just, I think you can't just project a Buddha or a Bodhisattva through imputation, which is why this little piece of Tulku Urdhva, he said, people say that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are just our own mind, so they're not really real. And I think he's talking about, we just create them. So I think it's more subtle than that, and yet they're not external to us either. I think quite hard to really fully understand in a conceptual way. Yeah, there's an intersection. Kanodoko.
Yeah.
What's that?
It's feel and response, right?
Yeah.
Katagiri Roshi has a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful page on about it in Returning to Silence.
Oh.
Yeah, Catherine turned me on to that when a friend of mine who's a priest, an Episcopalian priest, and was making a book on prayer and asked me to write an essay on Buddhist prayer. And I went to Catherine and said, how? And she said, read this.
And
he talks about, when we go and we just like call something out to the night sky and then we feel this response that he talks about.
Yeah. Yeah. Dogen's other bodhicitta essay, he says, how does bodhicitta arise? Through kano doko. Sentient beings meeting Buddhas in that meeting. And again, what are we talking about Buddhas here? But that's a topic for next time. I think it's more about the viewer than the viewed.
I don't know. we're also saying maybe, maybe not. Mm-hmm. Maybe that there is a halo there. Mm-hmm. You just need to be in tune with it.
We have, you maybe heard the story of our wonderful ancestor, Asanga, who was really wanted to meet Maitreya Buddha. He's doing all his practices with the great aspiration to meet Maitreya Buddha for years and years, and nothing was working. And but meanwhile, he was building up, generating incredible amounts of merit, and it was maybe unfabricated merit because he didn't think he was getting anywhere. But actually, something was happening. So, especially developing compassion. So he came out of his like 12-year retreat and saw this dog, and it was like these Indian dogs, a mangy mutt, with full of with open wounds and maggots on them. And it's like, what can I do to help this dog? I want to remove the maggots from this wound, but I don't want to hurt the maggots or the dog, so my fingers are too calloused and worn from this tough retreat, but my tongue is soft. I'll remove the maggots with my tongue very carefully. And as soon as his tongue touched the open wound of this dog, the dog revealed itself to be Maitreya Buddha. And he was, of course, totally shocked and said, I've been here all along practicing with you, but your compassion wasn't fully, you weren't fully open until right now. So then he's like, I can't believe it, this is amazing. And he put Maitreya on his shoulders to honor him and carry him around town. And all these people in town are like, why are you carrying that mangy mutt on your shoulders?
I think Maitreya was carrying the dog.
Yeah. So, you know, he saw it. He saw Maitreya in his true form, but nobody else could.
Yeah. The silly question is, before there were human beings, and I know we talk about not only kalpas, but eons and expansions and contractions of universes, infinite numbers of times. But in this particular one, when there were no human beings, what did we talk about in terms of Buddha nature or bodhicitta?
When there were no human beings?
Well, there were no human beings. There were reptiles.
Yeah. You know? What did they talk about?
How do we relate to that? To that time of being?
Like in the in the Pleistocene period or whatever they call this, was there Buddha nature?
Yeah.
That's like a Zen koan.
Yeah.
Not just does a dog have Buddha nature, but does a Tyrannosaurus Rex have Buddha nature?
It's nonsense because there's no Buddha to refer to at that time. He came later. So that's...
Yeah, well, you know, Buddha is just the, you know, in this case, the union of emptiness and awareness, and I think that pterodactyls have that too. Yeah. they just didn't have a name for it. Then humans started getting in to incredible elaboration about what's going on with these beings.
There's a beautiful Indian tale from the Midwest about this particular tribe that was just totally starving. And out of nowhere, a deer appeared and waited to be shot and killed and eaten.
Yes, things like this. It's a very mysterious world.
Well, Buddha revealed what was already there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if Buddha had been walking around in the Pleistocene, or sitting under a tree in the Pleistocene, would have presumably discovered the same thing.
Yeah, it would have been there. It's there with or without.
And maybe Bibhashi Butsu Dayosha was there. So is there something in my left sleeve? Oh, look. Is there prayer in Buddhism?
Well, I wrote an essay about it. So there.
Yes.
It strikes me that the more culture of the conversation developed about idols and also about the unity of practice and enlightenment. That's very similar.
That's in here, yeah.
It's in line with the first paragraph of Hogan's essay, of this essay, that is, conviction. Very often, Hogan sets the main point. And there he says, basically, I'm the Himalayan, I like Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
I have a way out, isn't it?
Two truths.
But in fact, it's quite
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's keep going.
One other question. With respect to bodhisattvas, one of the things about Suzuki Roshi is most striking. Category two, perhaps not very simple. One is that every time you feel the insentient speaking to the insentient.
You feel that you felt the insentient coming through them?
The imperturbability of the stone mind.
Stone and tree mind.
No water. Now, the conversation, however, amongst the speaking of bodhisattvas and Buddhas as bodhisattvas. And we did mention that you can represent aspects of and your people as you represent. Are they bodhisattvas and Buddhas, or are they ways of speaking in a, I won't say metaphorical, but in a way which can be understood? To the Lotus Sutra, for example, I can even think of some of those bodhisattvas and mahasattvas as magical beings. But I don't have to. I can relate to them to my own feelings and my own aspects of consciousness.
Yeah.
How do you see that?
Yeah. Yeah. Like own aspects of consciousness, yeah.
So
I think the door keeps opening because bodhisattvas are trying to come into the room.
So
I went out and called them.
So they represent a literary way of expressing these immediate feelings and qualities of mind.
Yeah, it's like a creative imagination can express all that kind of thing. Right? It's amazing And it's very colorful. I think that's you know, the whole Mahayana is like into this realm instead of just here's the straightforward instructions and 10 steps. Maybe some of the earlier sutras have that, which I love that too, you know. It's like reading a manual. It seems like maybe it's hard to know if it really works exactly like that because it's so straightforward. But the Mahayana is like, okay, forget the manual. We're just going to like present all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas springing up out of the earth. And this whole sutra is celebrating the central teaching. But then you get to the end of the sutra and you're like, what was the teaching actually? A lot happened there, but was there some practice? So, and all those Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I think I heard that when Suzuki Roshi was teaching the Lotus Sutra, he started talking about the first paragraph where the setting of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and celestial beings, and he just kept going with that and never got beyond the first paragraph. Because a lot could be said about these beings. Yeah, they're not separate from our mind, because nothing is. And they're not merely the imputational nature of reality. There's a dependent arising quality of them. Or they're sambhogakaya, manifestations of, you know, the luminous empty mind. This is, well, it's just, you know, it's the great compassion mantra inside here that, you know, when it's activated, when it's rolled in the air, it radiates in 10 directions, like, you know, healing suffering. So is that just a mental imputation? Is that just like a nice idea? Or is there, if we put our like intention into that and really feel as if, kind of trust, yeah, my intention of doing that is actually sending out these like healing blessings to all beings, then our intention makes it so. And you say, well, do you need a wheel to do that? No. But the wheel might be a reminder. There's one teacher that I met over in Nepal who's kind of his trademark thing is that he's always has a prayer wheel in his hand. Most people don't occasionally use them, but he just, when he's giving Dharma talk, he's continuously or walking around or sitting. I don't know about lying down. Garchen Rinpoche? Garchen? You know? Yeah, every picture of him you ever see, he's always got a prayer wheel spinning. And people ask him about that, and he says, oh yeah, I'm just like, it's kind of uncomfortable to do it all day long. He's got a kind of a big one too. And, you know, he does switch hands from time to time, but like to pay attention to that while you're doing everything else that you're doing, it's kind of like, I see it as like, you're just always keeping in mind Avalokiteshvara, this compassion, right? And it's just a way to remember that. It's kind of beautiful. Is that really work that way? Is it magic? Or is it all intention? Again, I think that the whole world is born of intention of sentient beings. We have such a teaching. That's in the Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha. It's how does the world come to be? Through intention. And then he goes on to describe the structure of the physical universe. All comes to be through sentient beings' intentions. Dogen, yeah?
Yeah! You always get there 10 minutes before I have to go. It's like
However, foolish people in the lesser vehicles say, two, near the top. Some say creating images of the Buddha or building stupas is work of purposeful doing. This should be avoided. And remember, purposeful would be not wu wei, but wei. And I was thinking about this. I'm resonating with the word unfabricated for Wu Wei, because unfabricated could mean the Taoist Wu Wei of like natural, unfabricated flow activity, and it can also mean asam skritta, meaning like unconstructed, unconditioned dharmas. Unfabricated has that kind of double meaning in English. Do you have something about unfabricated?
So it's work of fabricated doing.
What's it say? Oh, that's your name. Unfabricated
nature.
Unfabricated nature. That's who Nanette really is.
The way Catherine has said it is ten men.
Ten men. Interesting. I have to look at these characters. So we could say some foolish people say creating images of Buddha or building stupas is the work of fabrication. There's fabricated activity. Actually, work here is karma. Fabricated activity or karma. This should be avoided. To give rest to thinking and focus the mind is free of doing or non-doing. Not producing anything and not making anything is genuine practice, or the unconditioned, unborn, unproduced is genuine practice. Contemplating, I think, is better than visualizing. Contemplating Dharma nature, Dharmata, and its reality, or the true mark of suchness, is a practice beyond doing, or is unconditioned practice. Have we ever felt that way? I confess, I've felt that way when I was dwelling in the lesser vehicle. Like, can we, for example, do we really have to have a work period in Sesshin? It's kind of like, it's all this active, fabricated activity. Wouldn't it be better to just continuously sit and drop off body and mind and all fabricated action in non-doing? Tenzo-san.
You would have no food.
Maybe that would be better too. I we might think sometimes.
Shall I experiment? Complete unfabricated zazen, non-doing.
Maybe not this sesshin.
I'm afraid people would drop off the song.
they would drop off body due to low blood sugar.
Or not like dieting. Is Dogen using the term of aspersion like lesser vehicle?
He's dissing.
Remember, he's not talking about the Theravada way of the elders here.
No.
He's talking about Hinayana, which should not be confused with Theravada or even Sarvastivada or Dharmaguptaka.
Which one is he talking about?
My understanding is that Hinayana is this term.
Another term that was
invented by certain people who also came up with or called themselves Mahayana to make a point about what their practice was. So they talk about Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, but they weren't necessarily talking about specific people. Or if they were talking about specific people, it wasn't like a sect of Buddhism. It was an attitude. This is my understanding. Hinayana is just like an attitude of kind of like self-engrossed, self-centered practice. It doesn't refer to like a school of Buddhism.
In India or where?
Yeah, in India is when they started. And in China and Japan too. Literally, actually, in Japanese, it's a small vehicle. It doesn't even actually say lesser. It just says small and then great vehicle for Mahayana. So he could say like a kind of a small-minded approach to practice. Now, I don't know, maybe historically they were referring to certain sects of Buddhism, but my understanding is that they actually weren't. I mean, there were different approaches to practice, and there were all these different schools, and the Mahayana became a kind of movement. But in modern times, we have, actually, by the way, I just recently heard the word Theravada was actually invented in like the last 100 years. I think by a Westerner. I was shocked at that. I think a Westerner invented the word Theravada to talk about the school, which was before, which is called the Buddhism of, you know, Sri Lanka and Thailand and Cambodia. They didn't call themselves Theravada, but somebody, in order to make a distinction, when they started realizing there's all these different forms, what do we call that? The way of the elders, which is a very respectful term, and or the old way. So I think we can, I feel comfortable about using the word Hinayana if we don't mean we're referring to some actual school of people.
But didn't Suzuki Roshi use that positively, like that Zen got a hint, we practice Hinayana, practice with a Mahayana
mind
or something like that?
That's true.
Because we do focus on, you know,
form and you know, old practices
by people who aren't into it. So maybe we're considered lesser vehicle too.
I think generally when I think Dogen and the Lotus Sutras, maybe where this term originated is, and they're making this point. I think it's generally, we can say it's not really about formalism, but maybe it'd be like formalism that's just really stuck up on oneself. Self-liberation without the bodhicitta.
Yeah, and I think using the term small-minded, that's a way to think about it too, that it's not in a whole class of people, it's more an attitude.
It's an attitude, yeah.
When
so anybody, yeah.
On our own little tiny thing and don't consider the broader.
A bodhisattva could slip into the small vehicle on and off throughout the day and probably do sometimes. I do. And that's what I think when my teacher Soki Rinpoche said, who's, I feel like, a great compassionate bodhisattva, he said, really, we're maybe really mostly not actually Mahayana practitioners, even though we might call ourselves officially that. He said, I think he said, including myself, I'm maybe not really Mahayana practitioner, because I'm not always practicing with this great compassionate attitude of it's all for the benefit of all beings, which really defines the great vehicle. So, yeah, it's not this. So let's say it's not dissing any particular group of people. It's just but it is kind of dissing an attitude, in a lesser vehicle. So basically saying, just don't do this non-doing practice, which Zen really celebrates, of course, right? So it was these lesser vehicle Zen people that Dogen heard saying, just give rest to thinking and don't do anything, not producing anything, not making anything. That's genuine practice, contemplating Dharma nature, the emptiness of all dharmas. And the true mark of reality is this unconditioned practice. To speak in this way has been a custom in India and China from ancient times to the present. Consequently, while people commit grave and serious crimes or faults, they do not create Buddha images or build stupas. Which we could say is like kind of interesting, because maybe people who are really into the ultimate view, Zen people sometimes can get there and say, to a point, to kind of slipping into a nihilistic non-doing attitude, say, well, we don't need all this, religious stuff, let's just practice non-doing. But often the people who do away with a lot of that stuff sometimes get into serious grave faults. Not always, but if they were building stupas, they could stay out of trouble. they are doing a lot of constructed, fabricated activity that's more harmful than building stupas could be sometimes.
Well, the question is, this world of building stupas and doing beautiful works and carvings like Sally did, which incidentally does imbue something into that. It doesn't just become a thing. It has the livingness of that. That's something we were talking about before.
It doesn't have to be just that activity. I think building stupas is a summary for all activities. But especially wholesome activities.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that, and let's say that's fine. And some people have an affinity for that. But then there also is the simple, the pastoral, the...
Of course, yeah.
Which can be, certainly in my opinion, I mean, meaning I basically, I guess, ascetic, but not necessarily. You could just be living and doing a simple life. And I'm not convinced that that couldn't take you to the same place as all of
them. Oh, yeah, I don't think Dogen would disagree with that. I think he's maybe making stupas as a summary of all wholesome practices. And it's nice because it pushes these questions for us more than just, you say, well, just, you know, living in nature and helping your neighbors. It would be easier, we wouldn't have to stop and think about it, but we want to spend our time building stupas when actually maybe our neighbors could use our help instead. It brings up the question more, right? So I think it's nice that it's, what is this? This kind of, what and with what attitude and intention are we making stupas?
Well, what I was saying was for people who have affinity for that, I could associate stupa with art, and you could say, well, that's a waste of time in a sense because you're not really producing anything. That was also kind of reaction to you saying, not producing and not, what kind of activity can you do, that's not producing and has no, art for art's sake and for no other sake, just for the sake of the doing of beauty and aesthetic.
Yeah, but Dogen's going to say it doesn't matter even if you're doing something that looks like it has more purpose. It's still actually unfabricated. But, form and emptiness are not separate. The two truths are not separate. So every activity, wholesome or unwholesome, is empty. But I think what's being referred to here is these practices like the five paramitas of giving and refraining from harming others, patience, diligent enthusiasm, and meditation practice are these like the bodhisattva practices, but when they're paramitad, when they're perfected, that means that it's giving beyond giving without any, it's unfabricated giving. And you could say, which is I think how I see, you could say making stupas is like a summary for these five paramitas that are actually fabricated activity in a way that they seem fabricated until they're perfected, which is the idea of, which is giving with, while realizing the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift. And you could say, well, how about then practice, how about practicing killing paramita? Killing beyond killing without any idea of that. But I would say, no, actually, that one doesn't work. It's something about these practices that bring happiness, which is merit, the result of wholesome, kind and harmless activities, but not just doing wholesome kind activities, then doing them in an unfabricated way, which is without the idea of separation between the doer, the deed, and the done to. So we could look at building stupas. I would say, anything that's done in the spirit of giving and offering and virtue and patience. And I think this union of these five paramitas with the sixth paramita of wisdom, that's seeing that these five go beyond themselves and are unfabricated, That's the complete bodhisattva path. It's the six paramitas all together.
Do you have to do these paramitas? Are they because we have sick minds? If we weren't sick, would we, or crazy the way you were talking about, in entering the way, if there was some way that we could live a simple life that didn't make us crazy, would we have to do these paramitas?
I would say, no, we wouldn't have to, because we would be naturally doing them always.
That's what I think.
Yeah, we'd be naturally just, and Buddhas, and bodhisattvas, you know, practice these long enough, then they become more and more effortless. And I think we all have some experience of that, right? You know, practicing becomes more natural. Virtue becomes more natural the more it's like a self-sustaining thing, right? The more we do it, the more it feeds on itself. So, yeah.
I mean,
until we're not sick at all, and then we're just, then it's just unfabricated giving,
yeah.
Without any thought of giving, and of course, because there's nothing to hold on to. Why not?
Because, I mean, lions don't have to work on paramitas, they're just lions. And if we were just people who didn't somehow get either evolved or diseased or whatever, you know, through some mysterious process, we wouldn't need to do this, but.
Yeah.
Or that is our nature, that we are a disease, that what we call disease is in fact our nature.
It's not our like truest nature.
Dangerous, killing, you know.
This is part of being a sentient being, and thus we have practices like this, and here we are. Taking them up.
That's one of the things to be not the way they are. This is not saying these things, but I don't feel them. But I mean, it's like, it's this argument that comes up, you know, in my mind about nature. Nature, to me, you know, doesn't, if you accept it, it's bittersweet. It's both, you said it. I was very touched when you said it before, that hearing the laughter outside, you started to adjust to it. And I said, well, what if it was a riot? And you just said, well, you could. That
would
be okay too.
Yeah, so I think these practices are more about ourself rather than other people's riots. So if we're in the middle of a riot, then I think it's a different story. Then I think it's time to stop rioting. yes.
There's also the aspect of sacred geometry with stupas, with the tonkas, which embodied energy points that can release from another dimension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and
energy into, mm-hmm. you know, which can be, it's not that it's different from the energy within ourselves, but it's not awake in ourselves, and these things like stupas have the possibility of awakening, enlivening its energies and meeting. So it's not stupa me, it's like one and not two.
Yeah, and things like this, I'm, you know, personally, I'm really open to things like sacred geometry being part of the dependently arisen world, just like acupuncture. Science has a hard time explaining that, but it seems to work. So there's many things in this world that we don't understand yet, but that have a function, and I think sacred geometry and the people have discovered amazing things when they're not spending their time having riots. They like sacred geometry, they're putting their time into things like that. So I'm totally up for that. And at the same time, it's interesting to keep checking with ourselves and the dependently arisen world about like magical thinking. Or like, you know, it's just interesting anyway for me. And it's a question that arises for me is, how much of this is just total human projection, which also has an effect, and how much is it like, is there an actual sacred geometry in the world? I mean, I fall into the school of believing a lot of pretty absurd stuff because I love it. So I kind of I kind of can see that there could be sacred geometry, but some other person might say, maybe sacred geometry is, and building a stupa according to these certain dimensions, which Dogen talks about too, actually, how to build a stupa in a particular way, could be just human, you know, imagination.
Well, we always have the possibility of going to that place.
Yeah.
No matter what we do. I mean, we can create something from an unfabricated place, and somebody looking at it will see it as a fabrication.
Yeah.
It's always like
that. Yeah, yeah, it's always like that.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Yeah. We could create it from a fabricated place and somebody could see it as unfabricated.
Right. It depends on where they are.
Yeah.
You know, and there you go.
Yeah.
In their energetic body.
Yeah.
What resonates with what they come into contact with, with their senses, with their inner channels, you know, it's all part of it.
Yeah.
Are they open? Are they flowing?
Yeah. There's a vast universe that we're part of.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, because we've been talking about magical thinking a lot, and that my own idea of that is just something that we don't understand yet. You know, that's all. It's something that our rational mind can explain.
And
somehow
we put it in another realm.
Yeah.
And maybe whether or not it's, you know, there's some actual working, some actual dependent co-arising more than just completely imagination or not. In some ways you could say it doesn't matter that much. It's just the person using it, how they're relating to it, right? So you could say, well, what's the effect? Like I had kind of like the curious mind that just like, well, I don't know if what's true or not, but let's try things out and see how they work.
In the context of being in an infinite, unknowable, completely all bets are off situation, which we do agree. We just don't know, right? I mean, it's not like maybe we will not. It's like this is just not for human consumption. and so that's being in that, then everything's magic. Because we're in a crazy, unexplainable, unknowable, magical meaning beyond our. And so that means any point of view is nonsense. Because nothing can be fixed in this all possibility, completely unknowable, wild thing, you know, that we can't touch and we can't name, then any position, any point of view, which I think this says, is it can't be real.
I think Suzuki Roshi said, the world is its own magic.
Everything.
Stan, did you have it? Before we go back to Dogen.
Just very simply, I think my thinking, everyone's thinking, is so geared because of our educational system and our way of thinking in the West toward the rational mind. And if there's so many other ways of cognition beyond the rational mind, then we tend to see everything in relationship to the rational mind.
Yeah.
And fortunately for us, the East doesn't do it that way. It never has.
Yeah.
And neither does the Indian tradition in this continent either. Most cultures don't. I mean, I always go back to the saying in Shakespeare, of Hamlet addressing Horatio and saying there are more things under heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy,
Yeah,
that is really true.
The Western world is in a way like, we even though maybe we say it's Judeo-Christianity, maybe even really unconsciously it's like scientific materialism is like our religion.
Yeah.
Really based, we believe science the most, but science is just a mental construction of a bunch of people, but because it uses a lot of tools and stuff, we give more validity than just the mind.
Yes.
Yeah, so there's all different ways. And science is very useful.
Buddhism a Western term?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Theravada and Buddhism.
Western Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
If you want to get to something specific thing, trying to feed people, maybe get them from dying, science is a pretty good way.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I don't know that religion is.
That's true.
Now, so, I don't, you know, I'm certainly very much in tune with much of what you've been expressing. But it's very shallow to put down science, which is the...
Oh, I wouldn't put it down.
Which is the accumulated effort of thousands of years.
Yeah.
It's a deeply cultural development.
Yeah.
Of great sophistication.
I would just say it seems like the Western religion almost seems like science.
Well,
but it's not a negative thing, but if it's the whole story.
I don't know that Catholicism or Judaism views things in that way.
I think a lot of people, it's true. There's different people, right? But some people these days, there seems to be some movement that's maybe the first time in the world. I don't know if first time, but that if religion doesn't fit into science, then we'll go with the science, even around religious issues. So it's almost like there's these two realms. Science, like you say, is very good for feeding people in the conventional world. Religion or spirituality is good for the ultimate truth and peace of mind. So they have different functions.
I don't see that there's a conflict anymore.
No, there shouldn't be.
And I think so far as there's a conflict, it's a mistake. It's, except when religion asserts things about causality or cause and effect which are testable and can be shown to be otherwise than religion states. Now, I don't know to what degree science has similar intrusions into religion.
I think there are. In both directions, there's intrusions.
It's very clear that there are ones in which religion intrudes into science and says things which are testable. And it's like, okay, this is such and such, it's not such and such.
According to science. Yeah.
According to what you can test yourself.
Like there is no global warming.
For example,
you can test.
For example, I don't know. I haven't seen so much where science intrudes and says this or that about religion. Which is, I don't see that so much.
I think there's some. I've come across some recent debates around life after death or what happens after we die, and some scientists will say consciousness is created by the brain organ, so when you die, that's the end. That's a scientific view, and it's kind of like, so that basically goes against maybe every major world religion. So there's some debate, you know. I think there's some intrusion in both directions, but there doesn't need to be. What does Dogen say?
Yes.
Well, some people, foolish people, are lost in a forest of delusion. They do not recite the Buddha's name or read sutras. They not only destroy the seeds of rebirth as humans or devas, but also deny their own Buddha nature, their own Tathagata nature. How sad. Although they've encountered the time of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, they've turned into the enemies of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Although they've climbed the mountain of the three treasures, they return empty-handed. Although they have entered the ocean of the three treasures, they return empty-handed. That means they have encountered the emergence of 1,000 Buddhas and 10,000 ancestors, but they do not have the opportunity to cross over to the shore of enlightenment, to attain tokudo, when we say tokudo means literally attaining, crossing over, or attaining salvation. so. It's that they don't have the opportunity for tokudo. And they miss the direction to arouse the mind, hoshin, for enlightenment. This occurs because they follow those outside the way and do not follow the sutras and true teachers. So Dogen's on a rant. Right? Every fascicle he's got to go on a little rant, or many of them. Quickly abandon the view that building stupas and other practices are not arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. Cleanse your body, mind, ears, and eyes, and disregard such views. Just follow the Buddha sutras, follow true teachers, take refuge in true Dharma, and study Buddha Dharma.
Whew. You just say don't build stupas?
No.
Do. Abandon the view
that it's a stupid thing to do.
That they're not arousing the aspiration. So, you know, we can... This is fire and brimstone, religious kind of...
What touched this off?
It may be that he's starting to talk about this, and then he's remembering conversations that he's had with people, or maybe there's people in his audience who are like, can we skip the work period in Sashin? Because the true practice is just zazen. You know? So he's saying, how can you say that all kinds of virtuous practices are not totally as valuable as zazen? I think we didn't know who he's thinking about. In the great way of Buddha Dharma, there are thousands of sutras in one particle, in one dust mote. There are countless Buddhas in one particle. So this is like flower ornament world of where like there's worlds within worlds within specks of dust in the world. There's a whole other world system in this speck of dust, and the Flower Ornament Sutra goes on for thousands of pages about just the vastness and the inconceivability, small and large in all directions, and time and space all interwoven, and it's just the cosmic vision meant to blow our minds. You blow our like little rational minds. It's like, no, it's like, it's, this is just, you know, a cushion and a piece of wood. So Zen is just, you know, this is the pared down version. There's just thousands of sutras in one dust mote, and there's countless Buddhas in one dust mote. Both a blade of grass and a tree are the body and mind, which goes back to on page one, there was this thing about the take a blade of grass and make a Buddha, use a rootless tree to arouse the thought. So these, you know, inconceivably, our true body and mind is this, the vastness. Because myriad things are beyond birth or do not arise. The one mind is beyond birth or unborn. Because all things are the mark of reality, one particle is the mark of reality. Thus the one mind is all things. All things are the one mind, the entire body, the whole body. In the Fukanzo Zengi, Dogen says, the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. You could say our true whole body is the inconceivable, interdependent flow of the universe.
Would you equate that with Dharmakaya?
Yeah, the whole body. Dharmakaya. I'll go for that. Yeah. Therefore, all things are the one mind, the Dharmakaya. Yeah. All these, you know, Zen phrases, like the one mind that includes everything. Yeah. So, I'm saying all these conventional things like sutras and so on are actually in this vastness and conventional things like dust motes contain sutras. If building stupas and other practices were purposeful activity or conditioned activity, then enlightenment or Buddha, the fruit of awakening and the Buddha nature of true thusness, would also be purposeful or conditioned activity. So this is the argument here now. Can you see where he's going? He's saying, if you're going to say, you're going to discriminate and say, well, building stupas and making Buddha images, that's conditioned activity of doing, but then, Buddhahood and the inner practices of letting go of all conceptuality, that's, unconstructed, which we easily can do, right? We can make that discrimination, but Dogen's saying, let's not make that discrimination, because actually everything, whether it's the most, sublime spiritual practice or the most clunky, solid, smelly turd, is both are equally the union of form and emptiness and the two truths. If they manifest at all in mental or so-called physical ways, then that's, that manifestation, that appearance is like form, and all form is by nature empty. So if we say that building stupas is purposeful activity, that it's not empty, but it's actually just, it's a fabricated thing, then dropping off body and mind will be fabricated. He's breaking down the differences between offering incense and bowing and totally letting go. It's like they all fit into the same realm of, they all appear and they're all empty. These activities are, actually says, these activities are merit and virtue beyond purpose. Or again, referring to the unconditioned merit and virtue, undefiled beyond desire, or undefiled merit and virtue. So again, it's this union of, it's not just unconditioned, it's actually unconditioned merit, which is, we've been discussing extensively, which is this positive energy created by actually letting go of unwholesome mind states and activities and developing wholesome ones. So it's kind of like, it's kind of merit arises from a kind of discriminating thing of like, there are wholesome things and unwholesome things, and we're going to do the wholesome ones, like these five paramitas. And then you perfect these wholesome activities, you paramita them, and then they're undefiled. So that it's not that there's undefiled killing and stealing and lying, as my understanding, that's impossible. So there's something, it sounds kind of funny. Is it, we think there shouldn't there be, but it seems like there's something about, it's selfless activity that then you drop off the defilement by realizing that there's no separation. And maybe you could say, well, why not have undefiled killing or unwholesome activity? I think it's because the very action of killing is always based on this strong view of self and other. So it's like that conventional setup there, that basic fact of like, non-virtuous activities are always based on this, maybe we could say like a stronger delusion. Virtuous activities are also somewhat based on delusion, because they're based on the delusion of I'm giving a gift to that person. So it's, but this is just coming to mind. I would say that that's less deluded. I'm going to give this person a gift. It's somewhat deluded because it's me and them separate. but it's less deluded than I'm going to kill that person or steal a gift from them, because that's really, now we're really separated, and we're really, and we're kind of solidifying the separation. Whereas giving the gift has the potential to be, it's very close to non-delusion. It's just this last little step of like, now I'll give it, but without any sense of separation.
Is loving giving? Or is it, or?
What do you mean loving?
An ineffable, undescribable sense of connection and
so the feeling.
Intimacy. And joy that arises not only between people, but, you know, I mean, and when that comes, is that a gift? Is that a giving? Or, you know, is there, or is that something that...
Yeah, I think it is a giving. Even if, like, you're contemplating your love for someone and they don't, they're not even around, still, I think it is a gift, actually.
I'm not contemplating. Just
well, feeling it. You're feeling the love for someone that they're not around. Is it still a gift?
A mother.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm saying when they're not around, because when they are around, then it's quite obviously it is a gift. When you're radiating the love for your baby right in front of you, of course that's a gift.
I don't think it's a gift.
Oh, you don't?
No, I think it's just, I think it's flaw. I think it's...
How about...
There's no thought in giving it.
Well, then maybe it's undefiled giving. It's maybe it's dana paramita, which means there's no thought of giving. Dana paramita means there's no thought of giving, but it's still giving. So maybe that natural, maybe mothers and their children have natural dana paramita sometimes. And then, you know, we have to work at it. Usually, because it often doesn't come naturally, right? So we can practice somewhat defiled giving, which is still an excellent thing to give, like, I'm going to give something to you, or I'm going to, like, cultivate love for, you know, we have practices of generating loving kindness that we're, because we don't feel it, but let's do some practices to generate it. We have these, right? So we can do that, and then gradually it can become pure and natural flow.
Yeah, that's one thing. And there's the other is that you don't have to cultivate it and it just flows. But where there's instruction, you have to cultivate it.
No, so we could say, although we know that it doesn't continuously flow towards every being all the time for most people. Right? So in that case...
Yeah, because there's obstruction.
Yeah.
There's something wrong.
So when it doesn't, then do we want to just wait for it to happen, which is one approach, or do we want to actually, like, cultivate it as a practice? And this is kind of a theme for this year at Zen Center here. Loving kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta are like something I'd like to think about, like, do I want to actually, like, cultivate, not just look at what they are, but actually, like, generate them. And I don't know. It's kind of contrived and fabricated. But so is Zazen, Dogen's saying. If we say that those are contrived and fabricated, so is dropping off body and mind. So, know and trust that building stupas and related practices are no other than arousing bodhicitta. Again, it doesn't, for those who missed that, it doesn't literally say aspiration. It's just that every time they say Hotsu Bodhishin, they're translating it in English as the aspiration for enlightenment. It's really arousing bodhicitta, literally. From this, the vow of practice grows and does not decay for a billion eons. This is called seeing the Buddha and hearing the Dharma. Interesting. Yeah, you know, doing these practices with the spirit and bodhicitta does not decay, but grows further and further. Know that creating Buddha images and building stupas by assembling or collecting wood and stone, piling up dirt, collecting gold, silver, and the seven treasures, which is one thing that they sometimes put into stupas. They collect treasures and valuable things. Is no other than creating Buddha images and building stupas by assembling the one mind.
Assembling the one mind.
Yeah. Or, you know. So. A little sentient being. It's an ant, so it's not. So, no entrusted building stupas and related practices are no other than, the creating Buddha images and building stupas by assembling wood and stone and piling up dirt and so on is no other than creating Buddha images and building stupas by assembling the one mind. In other words, piles of dirt and the seven treasures and all are the one mind. How could they not be? They're manifestations of the one mind appearing as dirt outside the mind temporarily. This is creating Buddha images by collecting emptiness on top of emptiness. Collecting, right? This is creating Buddha images by taking up mind on top of mind. This is building stupas by laying stupas on top of stupas. Or another translation is building stupas by piling up stupa after stupa. This is creating Buddha images by actualizing Buddhas on top of Buddhas. Now, Dogen's in his element now. This being so, a sutra, the Lotus Sutra, says, when this is contemplated, all Buddhas in the 10 directions emerge or manifest. I don't know what it's referring to. I didn't look in the sutra. But when this is contemplated or thought or intent, actually it is the Chinese character for chetana or intention. So we could say, when there's this intention to pile up stupas on top of stupas with the one mind and as the one mind, when this is contemplated or intended, all Buddhas in the 10 directions emerge. So like, I want to practice making stupas and building images in this inconceivable way that's like, or I don't even know who's doing it anymore. That intention arises, all Buddhas arise. Know that when one contemplating Buddha emerges, all contemplating Buddhas in the 10 directions emerge. Or another translation, know that when one thought is making a Buddha, all thought Buddhas in the 10 directions emerge. So like, maybe this is something a meditation one can do during Zazen. I can't stop thinking, these thoughts one after another arise. But then we could see, they're thought Buddhas. They're not just thoughts, they're thought Buddhas. And know that when one thought is making a Buddha, then all these thought Buddhas emerge. When one thing becomes a Buddha, all things become Buddhas. Or when one Dharma makes a Buddha, all Dharmas become Buddhas. Shakyamuni Buddha said, when the morning star appeared, I simultaneously with all sentient beings and the great earth attained the way. You know that story? That, which I think is not found in the scriptures. It's a Zen story. I'm pretty sure that we talk about the Buddha was all... The Zen story, I think it says, agrees with the sutras. The Buddha was doing all this practice and eventually sat down under the Bodhi tree and got really, really calm and settled, and then started investigating the nature of reality. And then the final moment of his great enlightenment was looking up and seeing the morning star, maybe Venus, the goddess of love, in the morning. And that was his awakening. It kind of has a Zen koan flavor, right? Like seeing peach blossoms.
Was it dawn?
Yeah, even in the sutras, I think they say, you know, it was an all-night meditation, and at dawn, he realized the Four Noble Truths and dependent co-arising. So, but this, it's interesting that they add in this element of like looking up and seeing the morning star, and maybe that's just to make it less conceptual, which Zen likes to do, make it a direct meeting of something. Because all these Zen koans of the enlightenment stories of all the ancestors are almost always someone meeting someone. So we have, if we look at these, at the Zen ancestors' enlightenment stories, and we start with Shakyamuni Buddha, we say, well, who did he meet? Was he just contemplating something in his own mind? So yeah, he was contemplating, but the direct moment was a meeting. And since there weren't any ancestors before him, he had to meet the morning star.
But the reason why I'm drawn to this is because in Castaneda, Don Juan talks about dawn and evening, those points of infinite are the cracks in the world where magic can happen.
Dawn and dusk?
Those are the two places where the cracks in the world happen. And you see between reality and
interesting. Yeah, so that's another thing, kind of like sacred geometry, right? It's like, is that true? And again, I kind of like, yeah. And I've heard that not only Don Juan, but in Indian traditions, both, I can't remember the source, but I have read this, I think both yoga teachings and Buddhist teachings are like the best from the discriminating mind point of view. Times for meditation are dawn and dusk.
Yes.
And here, yeah. So here we follow that in this very temple. We have dawn and dusk, and then we have high noon meditation for just to like some, you know, there's another kind of, and Zazen does feel quite different at noon. It's a whole different, all three of those times have a different feeling of the day, I feel. Yeah, and also, you know, morning star is interesting because science tells us that when we look up at those stars, they are, the nearest ones are like so, so far away. I mean, our sun is very far away too, but it's just, our sun is apparently a small star. So there's ones that look really tiny, are much bigger than the sun, and they're light years away. And what we're seeing is the nearest star, I don't remember the numbers, but it's multiple light years, right?
I hate to say it, but the morning star is actually a planet.
Well, morning star is Venus. Yeah. So that's not so far. So this is with stars.
Yes.
With stars, there's some, I don't know how many light years, but they're pretty far. Venus is pretty far, but not as, you know, that's not that far, it's true. Stars are like, what we're seeing is the light, that the star could be long gone.
Oh, that's right.
You know? Thousands of years.
Yeah, of light years, right?
Thousands of our years.
Yeah, so at the speed of light, the star could be gone long, long ago, mm-hmm. but we're seeing something traveling through space like that. And to look up at the stars and contemplate that, in a way, I think meditating on that scientific fact that wasn't known in the Buddha's time is a kind of a, I feel it's kind of a Dharma opening teaching. is a way to, I'm relating to something that may not be there, but it's appearing. It's maybe really not there, but it's appearing. And like, what is that? And the fact that like, we have this little sense receptor eyeball that emerged out of the goo of this planet and consciousness and all of that, that now like can perceive thousands of light years away and receive and kind of meet, you know, touch. We're contacting in a way like something so beyond our comprehension. That's kind of a nice meditation. I mean, I appreciate sometimes thinking that I feel more relaxed. I feel more like my problems today about like, you know, giving a Dharma talk or something are like really not very significant in this relationship with this star. And so I'm not saying that's what happened to Buddha when he saw some star in the morning or Venus or whatever, but something about the vastness of this, of relationships outside our little world, was like the thing that finally tipped him over. He already maybe knew, I realize suffering and the end of suffering. I fully understand how this works. My enlightenment is unshakable. This is my last birth. And then he looked up and was like, ah, that's just like the icing on the cake. Thank you, star, for confirming this. Thank you, Earth, for confirming this. The icing on the enlightenment cake, right? Like in Zen, they say that they kind of sometimes criticize icing on the enlightenment cake. They say it's like adding frost to snow. Skillful means to, you know, relate to objects and physical objects and physical activities in the world. We can just meditate thinking, may all beings be happy, may all beings be happy, may all beings be happy. And then like, well, let's bring the body into it and bring art into it. You know, this is engraved mantras of Avalokiteshvara. And then creativity. To like, well, what, how can we like, you know, just to hold a mantra is kind of nice, but what about like moving it? So prayer flags is another one. You hang the mantra in the wind, and the wind sends out the prayer.
I mean, now we have just the word sacred.
Sacred.
Yeah. I haven't heard that word.
I wonder what that means.
Well, it's interesting that it relates to what starts to happen when you spin that.
Mm-hmm.
We become aware of the sacredness of. You know, we did. It's a pretty pregnant term.
Yeah, and Zen koan of Yancho or somebody stepping into the Buddha hall or the Zendo, where there's the little like door frame, and sometimes in Chinese temples that it's like a big threshold. You've seen that? Partly because the door is often like 20 feet tall, so as you see, if you had you put the whole thing to scale, a little door frame like that with a 20 foot door should be about that high. But yeah, you have to almost like you can barely walk over it. But yeah, that's how I've heard it. Is it keeps the demons, the spirits that are like that hover around the low ground, they bump into it, but people can step over it. Maybe the demons are sometimes called mice. Actually, they could go over it though. But
you also have to be aware she's going to trip.
Yeah, you have to be aware. But some Zen ancestor stepped, you know, halfway in, put one foot in the Zendo and one foot outside, straddled the threshold and said, is this ordinary or sacred?
Once again. Well, the mantra that's whatever the process is, it's on your bell, consists of seed syllables too. And the seed syllables, according to the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, are present in our central channel.
And that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and beings actually are condensed in the seed syllable as all like a seed.
Right.
And then they can so they're kind of it's like a computer chip holding all this stuff. Okay. And then they can manifest on the screen with 1,000 arms. And then they can go back into the chip.
The sound of that syllable activates the syllable in your channel.
Yeah. And Jerry, that to me sounds like science. Sound.
Yeah. It resonates and starts activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, the resonation starts the geometry.
On those Ofuda, those blessings with Ida Sonten, I'll give you one after this, Corinne. It's a little it's a Japanese tradition, Zen tradition, to make these little Prajnaparamita papers, and they usually put a seed syllable on. So this year's has Hong, the heart life of all the Sugatas.
Vibration.
I'm picking up good vibrations. We dedicate any good vibrations to all beings throughout the universe. May all be equally nourished. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.